Good Sunday afternoon. I'm Jeff Davis, your host today for Wordplay. And joining me today, a very special guest, Joanna Cooper. She's been a guest on our program before, talking about her own work, reading her own work. And today we're going to play an interview that Joanna conducted with Philadelphia poet Ross Gay. Hey, Joanna, how are you?
Hi, Jeff.
Welcome to Wordplay.
Thank you.
Let's start. Let's see. Ross, when was Ross here? He was
Here in February.
February.
Yeah, right around Valentine's Day. He did a couple readings, one at Malaprops, and I think he was out at Warren Wilson College. Uh-huh. Then I conducted this interview with him, which I recorded, that we are going to play parts of, selections of here in a minute.
That would be true.
So Ross and I went to grad school together, actually, at Temple University, so I was delighted to see him read and kind of follow his career. His first book came out a couple years ago. It's called Against Which.
Right, and that's most of the poems we're going to hear actually are from Against which
right.
is, yeah, quite a nice book.
How to fall in love with your father. Put your hands beneath his armpits, bend your knees. Wait for the clasp of his thinning arms, the best lock, cheek to cheek. Move slow. Do not, right now, recall the shapes he traced yesterday on your back, moments before being wheeled to surgery. Do not pretend the anxious calligraphy of touch was signed beyond some unspeakable animal stammer. Do not go back further into the landscape of silence you both tended with body and breath, until it nearly obscured all but the genetic gravity between you. And do not imagine that wind now blowing the same landscape into a river which spills into a sea, because it doesn't. That's not this love poem. In this love poem, the sun trains himself on the task at hand, which is simple, which is finally the only task he has ever had, which is lifting the father to his feet.
That's Ross reading at Malaprops on the same day you conducted the interview, I believe.
Right,
right. Right.
Yeah, it was a good reading.
It was a good reading. He did that with Patrick Rizal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to hear a couple cuts from that. But Joanna also had the foresight to ask Ross to read during the course of the interview, and his readings there are just excellent too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah. We have some good poems during the course of that interview, mm-hmm. and some extended conversation between the two of us.
Yeah, it's a good interview. Good interview.
Thank you.
Yeah, I believe you started off asking him about his background in writing, who his teachers were.
Right. I asked him a little bit about what he got out of the MFA experience. He went to Sarah Lawrence College before he got his PhD at Temple. And I asked him a little bit about his teachers, Gerald Stern and Tom Lux, who were both very influential in his life and work.
Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit of that interview.
You mentioned Gerald Stern. That idea of what you learned from him as a human being, what he modeled for you, that shows up in a poem of yours called The Voice, and you reference the coal, which is from his poem, The Red Coal.
Yeah.
There are these lines, it's there in your gut, burning the coal, he called it. We are at its mercy, he said, he who taught you how to wear tenderness like a shawl or a fedora. And that's such an important thread in your poems, that affirmation of tenderness, what my friend the poet Rebecca Howell recently called making a case for tenderness. You know, sort of moving through the world and seeing everyday interactions as this chance to make a case in your own mind for tenderness. So was that something that through models like Tom Lux and like Gerald Stern you were able to see poems as a way to process a lack of tenderness or you know, the possibility of not being tender and turn it into something else?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can even, just in terms of their the way they are in the world, with me, the way they were with me, was actually modeling tenderness. And it was modeling a kind of a, Yeah, they were models. They were both models of tenderness and sort of real, human, generous interaction. Also, if you look at their poems, you know, and you can't say this about everyone's poems. It's actually, yeah, it's the case that you can't say this about everyone's poems. But both of their poems are very often real kind of investigations into the thing, you know, into other people's experiences or meditations on things that seem hard to understand, which is sort of, you know, what you think of as being the job of poetry. But a lot of poetry is not like that. A lot of poetry is so self-involved that it doesn't actually provide for sort of compassion necessarily, or compassion that extends beyond the self. So I think Tom, you know, Tom's an amazing model for that in his work and in his person, but right now I'm talking about his work. And Jerry as well, you know, the poems of Jerry's that I think will really, really, really last are poems like The Dog and The Jew and the Rooster Are One and The Dancing, and a poem that's going to come out in his new book called Save the Last Dance for Me. All of these poems that are really about, finally, they're about compassion. That's what they're about. Yeah.
You have this really great poem that's about specifically male tenderness called Two Bikers Embrace on Broad Street. Could you read that one?
Yeah. Two Bikers Embrace on Broad Street. Maybe if you're something like me, you too would have nearly driven into oncoming traffic for gawking at the clutch between the two men on Broad Street in front of the hospital, which would not stop, each man's face so deeply buried in the other's neck, these men not to be fucked with, squeezing through that first porous layer of the body into the heat beneath. Maybe you, too, would have nearly driven over three pedestrians as your head swiveled to lock on their lock, their burly fingers squeezing the air from the angels on the backs of their denim jackets, which reminds you the million and one secrets exchanged in nearly the last class between your father and his brother, during which the hospital's chatter and rattle somehow fell silent in deference to the untranslatable song between them. And just as that clasp endured through what felt like the gradual lengthening of shadows and the emergence of once cocooned things, and continues to this day, so too did I float unaware of the 3,000-pound machine in my hands drifting through a stoplight while I gawked at their ceaseless cleave going deeper and deeper still, so that Broad Street from Fairmount to the Parkway reeked of the honey-scented wind pushed from the hummingbirds now hovering above these two men, sweetening somehow the air until nectar. Yes, nectar gathered at the corners of my mouth like sun-colored spittle, the steel vehicle now a lost memory as I joined the fire-breasted birds in listening to air exchanged between these two men, who are themselves listening forever to the muscled contours of the other's neck, all of us still and listening, as if we had nothing to blow up, as if we had nothing to kill.
Thank you. That poem, that's a great poem, and it seems almost like an experiment in how far you can push a description of tenderness with the hummingbirds and the nectar. And, of course, it works beautifully because it's, you know, you have the fact that they're bikers, you know, creating attention there. That Broad Street is in Philadelphia. Do you think of yourself as a Philadelphia poet or in part a Philadelphia poet?
Yeah, I think I do. I really think of myself as a, you know, because I was brought up right outside of Philadelphia, and I have lived most of my adult life in Philadelphia. And whenever I'm away, you know, I'm still basically, I mean, I consider myself really a Philadelphian. Like right now I teach in Indiana, but I also, you know, live at Walt's house and my buddy who lives in Philly. And a lot of my sort of social concerns come, you know, I mean, we'll see how this evolves over the years, but it comes, you know, it informs my work, you know, like I'm writing about, like, you know, let's say guns, and guns feel to me like a very, I mean, they're a very American problem, but they're also in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, where the legislation has their heads so far up their asses about things like guns. That feels like a very, you know, serious thing, and it informs my work. I don't know that I'd have that same subject matter if I lived in Minnesota, you know.
It's interesting that you mentioned Minnesota, because I know that at least a couple of the poems in the book come out of, you know, experience in Minnesota, where your mother's family is from. And that's another element of the book for me, is the sense of, it shows up in the biker poem as well, the sense of movement between places. So even within that poem, the speaker is traveling. So there's a sense in the book of travel between places. Can you talk a little bit about how movement between places has informed your work?
I think there's probably something really significant to being, you know, most people are kind of bicultural in some way, you know, like, you know, so there's the sort of what people, or maybe me sometimes, might consider like the overt or overriding by something, you know, my dad's black, my mom's white. But then there's this different thing, which is equally, I think, significant, which is that my dad's from Youngstown, Ohio, which is this steel town, basically. And my mother's from Verndale, Minnesota, which is a farming community. So she grew up actually outside of Verndale. She grew up outside of a town of 500 people. And she has a very specific sort of relationship and understanding of things like government and community and personal relationships that's probably different than the way that I, and my father's was, who lived in a steel town, who a lot of his family was either working at the steel mill or worked at the GM plant or were teachers, you know, but in a town, in a large town, in a large, actually a large, vibrant, black community too. So to be someone who holds those fairly disparate, cultural experiences, or who has inherited both of those experiences, I think it's probably inevitable that that'll come through in the work. And, I don't, you know, I think it probably happens a lot with a lot of poets. I mean, we're mostly like that, I think. Or a lot of us are like that. But I do think, it informs the work.
Do you think, you'll start writing Indiana poems now? Is living in Bloomington, Indiana going to show up in your work?
Well, yeah, I think spending time out there is going to, already, you know, I have, you know, I've been out there for, you know, a couple months basically. And, you know, there's a really great farmer's market, and the people in the farmer's market are coming into my poems, you know? But yeah, so I don't know. We'll see. But I'm, you know, I remain in you know, in Philly or, Jersey or, you know, or the East, too. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves. Yeah. I don't know.
Your book is called Against Which, a great title. And it,
thanks.
You're welcome. And it immediately sets up a lacuna, a gap that draws the reader forward into the book, because we become curious. You know, we want to know against what, who against what. Mm. And the phrase comes from your poem, It Starts at Birth. Would you mind reading that,
yeah,
that poem?
Sure. It Starts at Birth. The newborn railing against the thing behind the sting of air and light, against which, too, are castles built and moats,
against which the futile howl of the body's trillion cells, against which he will bloody her nose often, and she will clasp and kiss the fists, against which the weight of lactating breasts and the gardener's mud-packed hands and eye lifts and the collector of the baby teeth of his departed children, against which we put up our hoods and walk backwards as if into an icy wind with the appetite of a river, against which the dazzle of gold-threaded embroidery inside the hangman's mask, the perfume of an ex-lover he sprays beneath the nose-hole, against which the membrane strangling the general's heart and the blossom of blood staining the ballerina's toe-shoes and the wet eyes of the dog whose lungs are muscled with tumors, against which thousands of languages, each one broken and blessed as the last, against which the coil of lovers blent beneath moonlight and their sounds, wind through the trees, against which the ascent of a crow into the night, a tendril of carrion dangling in the clutched beak, and a moment, a diamond of starlight streaking its black wing, which is what we, against it, are. Impossible, golden, longing, gone.
Thank you. The title of the book, Against Which, it just resonates in so many different ways. It seems like from that poem, the poem suggests that all human gestures, love, sex, art, language, violence, grieving, reproduction, they're all products of just some inescapable lack or some, you know, deep knowledge of death. And then, so your book itself almost becomes one of those gestures. You know, well, here's another one.
Yeah.
But so many of your poems are also about a repudiation of brutality and about bearing witness to pain and loss. So there's this feeling that Against Which is about making a case against brutality. Mm. How are you thinking of the title?
Yeah, there was this way that poem, a former student who's now my friend, her name's Nora Kennedy. We were talking one day after class or during class, I don't know. And she was talking about how it is the case that so often we go through our lives without acknowledging the fact that we're going to die. Yet we act all the time crazily on account of the fact that we're going to die. So that poem is actually, you know, it's kind of comes out of her. And I feel like that's sort of the point of this poem, that so many of the things we do, many of the ways we operate, which are a zillion different ways, which are beautiful and also like zany and awful, are often about, like, when you boil it right down to it, it's about fear of dying or, you know, trying to hoard as much life as you can, which doesn't seem to work. So then the book does. Yeah. The book, I thought that ends up making the book a pretty interesting metaphor if the book is called Against Which and the book is another sort of attempt to hold off that thing. Which is interesting, you know, because when I wrote this book, I sort of believed that. I believed that a book of poems is a good gesture against which, or against which a book of poems, but I don't feel that way anymore.
Wow, what changed?
I don't really... I don't think I'm writing poems in relation to mortality anymore. I'm not like thinking about it. I'm trying to imagine like ways that poems can help me become more compassionate and other people too. So it changes, you know, it's not about being compassionate. I mean, it's about being compassionate here, and it stops being about like fighting something. It's about here, you know? So it's really sort of inarticulate, because I feel like it's sort of this emerging thing in my head. But it's different.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because when I read your poems and I sort of think about the metaphysics or the spirituality, the philosophy that seems to emerge from them, there's this interrelated kind of almost Buddhist celebration of the moment, you know, this kind of Zen, like just be here. And then this kind of almost pagan clinging to just be here.
Do
you feel like, I know that you've done some reading in Buddhism and have an interest in it. Do you feel like that informs this process for you of thinking through these issues?
Yeah. I mean, those, you know, texts, matter to me, but all the interesting teachings on compassion are really interesting to me. They become more interesting to me lately. And all of the concepts of compassion that, you know, run through all of the spiritual teachings, like, you know, say compassion in Buddhism, or I don't know if it's called compassion in Christianity or in Judaism, maybe it's like the pity. I mean, I've been thinking more about that, a lot more about that lately. And so it's certainly like I'm conscious of it having informing my newer work. But that's always been something that really interested me, I think, though in these really complicated ways, you know, and it comes through in the work. Like, I mean, in the work's really rough a lot of times. It's there's these sort of explorations of violence, but, you know, the explorations of violence are, they want to be, I think, and this is like a critical assessment of my own work, being inside of the work, which is not always the best critical way to do it. But I think they want to investigate violence or investigate harshness or stupidity so that we might understand better how to avoid that kind of thing, which is called compassion. You know, it's called compassion. It's called compassion when you understand people who do violence to you. That's compassion as well. So, yeah, I mean, your question was basically, does Buddhism affect me? Yeah, I think that, yeah, all that, the main Buddhist tenets, they're amazing. They're great.
That's Ross Gay talking with Joanna Cooper in what, February of this year?
That was February.
Right. And you're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. This is WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. Now we'll listen to some more of the interview of Ross Gay.
I'm interested in your exploration of violence and how that, you know, is ultimately a gesture toward compassion. There's a tricky line, maybe, that happens, though, in some of the poems where there's almost a bemused quality to it. And it's almost as if the speaker is just interested in investigating what is brutality. And, you know, I'm wondering, like, is there some kind of moral imperative not to be too interested in it, or to balance it out with really thinking always about what, you know, what really you're doing with the investigations of violence? But I mean, at the same time, there's a long tradition of writing about that extreme of human experience of violence and degradation. And I think that's so interesting, that question of in fully inhabiting it, the matter of factness of it, do you reinforce, like, yeah, it happens, we'll get used to it, or do you fully inhabit it to the point where you crack it open and question it? One of your poems for me that had me kind of on a fuzzy line between those was about a kid who poisons a dog, or who considers poisoning a dog. And I think
no, he kills him with a shovel.
Oh, he kills him with a shovel?
Yeah.
Oh, he gives him the meat to distract him, yeah. And then he kills him with a shovel.
That's my grandpa who did poison the dog.
Really?
Yeah.
And a version of this poem got published in APR, and was it right that you wrote two versions,
yeah,
one in which he actually killed him and one in which he recognized the dog's not humanity, but, you know, recognize the dog as a fellow being.
Yeah.
And you chose to publish the one.
No, I didn't. They chose it.
Oh, they chose it.
Yeah, I submitted both.
Oh. Yeah. Was your idea to publish both of them?
No, although probably at some point I will, in the book maybe. Okay, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt.
No, I was just interested in that. So, you know, when you're writing those two versions, did you want them to be read side by side, or were you just curious, you know, which one they would choose when you submitted those?
I see. So there's the poem in which the boy, because the boy feels, there's this poem. Should I read the poem?
Yeah, read the poem.
Okay. It's called Bringing the Shovel Down. Because I love you, and beneath the dying stars have become the delicate piston threading itself through your chest. I want to tell you a story I shouldn't, but will, and in the meantime, neglect, love, the discordant melody spilling from my ears, but attend instead to this tale. For a river burns inside my mouth, and it wants both purgation and to eternally sip your thousand drippings. And in the story is a dog, and unnamed it leads to less heartbreak, so name him Max. And in the story are neighborhood kids who spin a yarn about Max like I'm singing to you, except they tell a child, a boy who only moments earlier had been wheedling through sticker bushes to pick juicy rubies, whose chin was, in fact, stained with them. And combining in their story, the big kids make the boy who shall remain unnamed believe Max to be sick and rabid, and say his limp and regular smell of piss are just two signs. But the worst of it, they say, is that he'll likely find you in the night. And the big kids do not giggle, and the boy does not giggle, but lets the final berries in his hand drop into the overgrowth at his feet. And if I spoke the dream of the unnamed boy, I fear my tongue would turn an arm of fire, so I won't. But no, inside the boy's head grew a fire beneath the same stars as you and I, love. Your leg between mine, the fine hairs on your upper thigh nearly glistening in the night, and the boy, the night, the incalculable mysteries as he sleeps with a stuffed animal tucked beneath his chin and rolls tight against his brother in their shared bed, who rolls away. And you know by now there is no salve to quell his mind's roaring machinery, and I shouldn't tell you, but I will. The unnamed boy, on the third night of the dreams which harden his soft face, puts on pants and a sweatshirt and quietly takes the spade from the den and more quietly leaves his house where upstairs his father lay dreamless and his mother bends her body into his. And beneath these same stars, love, which often, when I study them, seem to recede like so many of the lies of light. The boy walks to the yard where Max lives, attached to a steel cable spanning the lawn. And the boy brings hot dogs, which he learned from Tom and Jerry, and nearly urinating in his pants, he tosses them toward the quiet and crippled thing limping across the lawn, the cable whispering above the dew-slick grass. And Max whimpers, and the boy sees a wolf where stands this ratty and sad and groveling dog, and beneath these very stars, Max raises his head to look at the unnamed boy with one glaucous eye nearly glued shut and the other wet from the cool breeze. And wheezing, Max catches the gaze of the boy who sees, at last, the raw skin on the dog's flanks, the quiver of his spindly legs. And as Max bends his nose to the franks, the boy watches him struggle to snatch the meat with his gums. And bringing the shovel down, he bends to lift the meat to Max's toothless mouth and rubs the length of his throat and chin, Max arcing his neck with his eyes closed now and licking the boy's round face until the boy stands, taking slow steps backward through the wet grass and feels, for the first time in days, the breath in his lungs, which is cool and a little damp, spilling over his small lips, and he feels again his feet beneath him and the earth beneath them and starlings singing the morning in and the somber movement of beetles chewing the leaves of the white birch glinting in the dark. And he notices, darling, an upturned nest beneath the tree, and flips it, looking for the blue eggs of robins, but finds none, and placing a rumpled crimson feather in his mouth, slips the spindly thicket into another tree, which he climbs to watch the first hint of light glancing above the fields, and the boy eventually returns to his thorny fruit bush, where an occasional prick leaves on his arm or leg a spot of blood the color of these raspberries and tasting of salt. And filling his upturned shirt with them, he beams that he could pull from the earth that which might make you smile, love, which you'll find in the fridge, on the bottom shelf, behind the milk, in the bowl you made with your own lovely hands.
So that's the version where he doesn't kill a dog.
Yep.
And how did you come to write two? Was it, did you just sort of make it an exercise for yourself to do one that was like dog eat dog world and one
dog
that was
save dog? No, I wrote the original poem, and it's called Bringing the Shovel Down, because in the original poem, the bringing the shovel down is when the dog gets killed. And then, because that poem, that the original poem where the dog dies is like a meditation on how we come to be violent. And how we come to be violent is, it's very human. It's like out of terror. And it's actually precisely, I think, the way that we as a country were convinced to go into a war. And I didn't exactly realize this while I was writing it, but it's exactly the thing. The rhetoric around, I mean, all of our political rhetoric lately around the war is based on making people terrified and feeling that there are enemies who want to kill you and want to hurt you bad. So in the poem, the same thing's happening with this dog. This boy is, you know, feels threatened or terrorized by this dog. And it's not, you know, and he spins it out of control. And in the first poem, it kills him and he feels better. And then I was sort of thinking about what that actually means and what might be the, you know, what might be the sort of the poem that begs a different question, that begs the thing that I would actually, ideally want to do myself. So the thing that I would ideally want to do myself is to be able to encounter the thing that I imagine wants to kill me and realize probably it doesn't, you know, and then give it some hot dogs. But the thing of it is that if we aren't able to, like, how am I able to be a real critic, a real vocal critic, or an insightful critic of an administration that is a warmongering administration, or a nation, actually, historically, which is a warmongering nation? How am I able to be that kind of a critic in that way if I'm not able to understand, or I'm not willing to understand or interrogate my own, say, capacity for violence, or capacity to be stirred toward violence based on fear? You know, I feel like if I'm able to interrogate it in myself, then maybe I'll have a greater understanding of what the hell we're doing, you know? Yeah.
You have other poems that bear witness to historical violence, and specifically a couple about racial violence in your book. One is about the murder of Amadou Diallo called Marionette, and another one called Postcard Lynching of an Unidentified Man, circa 1920. Could you read that postcard poem?
Postcard Lynching of an Unidentified Man, circa 1920. It's not his imperceptible sway or the whine of the rope's braid straining against his weight, or his right pant leg shoved above his shin. It's not the wide blade of light slicing the snapshot behind the body or through him, depending on your angle. It's not the way his still-tucked white shirt becomes that light, becomes the source of that light. Not the way the dead fist inside his chest becomes the source of that light. It's not the way Everyone save him looks at the camera, poses. One young man, nearly handsome, pushing the hanged body so he might fit more snug into the frame. Or the way an adult turns a child toward the camera, as if to say, stand still so they can see what we've done. It's not the neck's torque and bulge or the skin's color. It's the angle of the head. It's impossible, owlish twist towards something only he can see, or away from something only he can see. It's as though the same flash that makes the dumb-looking boy grin, to the hanged man, it burns.
There's a beauty to that poem, in the description of the image and the glowing shirt. Do you think that there's something, that there can be something redemptive about, the poem almost investigates that in a way, that the photograph itself, you know, has this within it. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about the poem?
Yeah, there's a kind of, I mean, again, like reading this poem, whenever I write about violence or this kind of violence, you know, there's a question of aestheticizing it, which is tricky. It's a really tricky thing. And reading it now, I'm thinking this is tricky. I mean, I think part of what you're asking is there the sense that there's something not redemptive in the violence, but maybe redemptive in the poem's assessment of the violence and maybe the work that the poem can do against the violence, or in helping us to understand the violence. And I think there probably is. And even looking at the language that, you know, there is, although it's dead, there's a fist inside his chest, and there's light, there's a lot of light. So maybe the poem in itself is about casting light on that history, you know, which I think is a really significant, it's probably a really significant thing to do. I mean, there's no probably about it. It's like if we're going to recover or not even recover, like reimagine what it means to be a nation, then probably it's like casting light on our history is pretty significant, and reorganizing our mythologies, which is to say, to me, like maybe having a sense of why we have the old mythologies, which are wrong, you know, which are lies, you know, mythologies of like progress and equality and, you know, these things that aren't actually true, but they seem to sustain us in our perpetuation of other things. And then maybe like figuring out other mythologies. But I'm looking at this poem and the end of the poem, it's finally, it's about trying to understand that was a man. And all of those images, this is a poem in response to that Without Sanctuary, that book of postcards of lynchings that was touring the United States maybe 8 years ago or so. It's about really acknowledging that in that body, there's a man. Because those photographs, there's a way that dead bodies they stop being people, you know, and the people who are alive in those photographs are the white people, and in some way the people who are complicit in the violence. I think this poem means to say that that was a living person.
We've been listening to Ross Gay, a conversation he had with Joanna Cooper on February the 15th of this year. This is WPVM. You're listening to Wordplay. I'm Jeff Davis. Joining me today, Joanna Cooper herself. Hey, Joanna.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah. And now we'll hear a little bit more in just a second from Ross Gay.
Ooh.
is your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in right away.
What are your habits? Do you write every day?
Nope. I mean, I probably write lines or words every day. And by words, I mean like a word, just to remind myself of an idea for a poem that I might have. I'm sort of always with little notes on paper that I'm carrying around and stuff like that. But I don't have a real firm schedule. I don't wake up early. I don't stay up late to do that kind of thing.
Do you have specific places that you like to write?
I travel a good bit, so I think I write a little bit on airplanes and in transit. Not real specific. I used to drive so much that I got into a habit where I could only write in my car. Like, I stopped being able to sit down someplace that wasn't my car. I think it was just because I was in my car all the time.
Well, you would drive and write at the same time?
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
It was dangerous, yeah. Totally dangerous. I was driving to basketball practice like every hour of my life.
When you're coaching.
When I was coaching, yeah. But I don't have a real steady schedule. And I don't feel nervous. I was just telling a student this yesterday that I don't feel nervous if I'm not writing or if I don't write for 2 weeks. I mean, I think I might get a little something. But if I'm reading a lot, I don't care. And I feel like for me anyway, reading is as much of the work as writing is. I think that's probably the case for younger writers and more sort of like me and, my students. I think like really pounding through a lot of reading is probably just as much of the work. All my teachers have said that, Jerry always says, something like 90%, read 90% and write 10%, or something like that. And I believe that.
Do you write a lot of material do you have to write a lot to get a poem? Does it kind of compost where you produce a lot?
I like that, compost. Yeah, I am. I throw a lot out. I try a lot of starts and I chuck that out. And that's all part of my thing. I know some people who are able to more kind of get a good clean draft like right off the bat. Me, I feel like I have a lot of starts that don't turn into anything for a while, and I think that's often because I write toward a subject. I have an idea that I want to write about, and so entering it is always tricky. I don't know what I want to say about it, but entering it is always tricky, as opposed to some people who start with like a musical thing, a couple words or a line, and they'll see where that goes. And I feel like that's maybe it's a little bit more intuitive, so it's a different kind of process.
There are several poems in your book that are elegies to your father, and one thing I noticed about those is that it seemed to me as a reader that you were experimenting or finding new ways to write about the experience of your father's illness and death. Different music comes out in some of those. Would you mind reading a couple of those?
Yeah, sure. Should I, which one do you think? How to Fall in Love with Your Father?
Yeah.
How to Fall in Love with Your Father. Put your hands beneath his armpits, Bend your knees, wait for the clasp of his thinning arms. The best lock, cheek to cheek. Move slow. Do not, right now, recall the shapes he traced yesterday on your back, moments before being wheeled to surgery. Do not pretend the anxious calligraphy of touch was signed beyond some unspeakable animal stammer. Do not go back further into the landscape of silence you both tended with body and breath until it nearly obscured all but the genetic gravity between you. And do not imagine wind now blowing that landscape into a river which spills into a sea, because it doesn't. That's not this love poem. In this love poem, the sun trains himself on the task at hand, which is simple, which is, finally, the only task he has ever had, which is lifting the father to his feet.
That one seems quieter to me than some of your other ones, and
yeah,
simpler music, almost.
Yeah, it is. It sort of lilts.
And then there's another one called Litany that almost does the opposite, yeah, where everything becomes even more torqued. Do you want to? That's a short one. Do you want to read that one?
Yeah, Litany. Say birdsong at death's bedside, plus honeybees there hover and thirst. Say thickets of clover a quiver, the gold swell limning morning clouds, the light behind it. Say wet eyes, the orb's cock-eyed swirl extubate. Say the honey between nape, scapula, a slow ride between two points, the plush rug of ivy swallowing this tree, pissing in a wood. Say the last rattle of the thorax, the peristaltic earth. Say home, say. Very different poems.
Very different.
Yeah, the racket is way different. It's kind of, you know, like you said, torqued or sped up. The lines on the page are super enjammed and super you know, the narrative is embedded, but it's, you know, it's an imagistic poem in a way.
And it's a different type of elegy. It almost seems like, you mentioned the term praise poem at a recent reading. It almost seems like it's elegy plus praise poem.
Yeah, that's
right. Or, you know, two different ways to write about.
Yeah.
To celebrate somebody or to remember somebody at the same time.
Yeah. Because butting up right up against, like, you know, it's the orb's cockeyed swirl, extubate, say the honey between nape and scapula. So there's all this sort of the death and life and body and love all kind of like butting up right against the other, whereas the other one is basically just a sort of narrative that gives you a little history about a father and son. Yeah.
So you mentioned that in some of your new poems, you're exploring compassion, and are you writing more joyful poems, do you think, or?
I'm always writing joyful poems. But I think I have, am I writing more joyful poems? I don't know. You know, I feel like, I feel like I'm writing joyful poems for sure. I don't know if they're more joyful poems, because there's a lot of like these tough dog eat dog poems in this second manuscript too.
How far along are you in the manuscript?
I would say I'm probably maybe 2/3 through a book, maybe a year away from being done, maybe. Oh. Something like that. But I have some long poems in this book, so they go quicker. They fill up a book quicker.
Do you want to end with one of your newer poems?
Sure. I'm trying to think of an elegy that's a different kind of elegy. You know what, though? I think I'm going to read this poem, which is sort of sweet. It's called Opera Singer. Today, my heart is so goddamn fat with grief that I've begun hauling it in a wheelbarrow. No, it's an anvil dragging from my neck as I swim through choppy waters swollen with the putrid corpses of hippos, which means lurking somewhere below is the hungry snout of a croc waiting to spin me into an oblivion worse than this run-on simile, which means only to say, I'm sad. And everyone knows what that means. And in my sadness, I'll walk to a cafe and not see light in the trees nor finger the bills in my pockets as I pass the boarded houses on the block. No, I will be slogging through the obscure country of my sadness in all its monotone flourish. And so imagine my surprise when my self-absorption gets usurped by the sound of opera streaming from an open window, which means only that my budding neurosis has bloomed into delusion, for this is North Philadelphia. But I continue walking, and the sun peeks ever so slightly from behind its shawl, and this operatic singing is getting closer so that I can hear the delicately rolled R's like a hummingbird fluttering the tongue, which means a language more beautiful than my own. And I don't recognize the song, though I'm jogging toward it and can hear the woman's breathing through the record's imperfections. And above me, two bluebirds dive and dart, and a rogue mulberry branch leaning over an abandoned lot drags itself across my face, staining it purple. And looking now like a mad warrior of glee and relief, I run down the street, and I forgot to mention the 50 or so kids running behind me. Some in diapers, some barefoot, all of them winged and waving their pacifiers and training wheels and nearly trampling me, when in a doorway I see a woman in slippers and a floral house dress blowing in the warm breeze, who is maybe 70, painting the doorway. And friends, it is not too much to say it was heaven sailing from her mouth, and all the fish in the sea, and giraffe saunter, and sugar in my tea, and the forgotten angles of love, and every name of the unborn and dead from this abuelita only glancing at me before turning back to her earnest work of brushstroke and lullaby, and because we all know the tongue's clumsy thudding makes of miracles anecdotes, let me stop here and tell you I said thank you.
Well, thank you, Ross. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you very much.
It was nice to talk to you.
You too.
That's Joanna Cooper talking with Ross Gay on February 15th of this year. Now, here's another performance by Ross from his reading at Malaprops the same day.
A few things. I read this poem last night, too, so I apologize. Barry White, you all know who Barry White is. And Chana is, you know, that's chickpeas. Roti is a, what I'm talking about in this is a Trinidadian dish, curry, chickpeas, and potatoes. The best. And I bragged about it last night that I can make it so good. I've been bragging to Pat and Cootie. I was bragging to you the other day about it. No one's had it but me. Doubled is another food, Trinidadian food that, yo, watch out, I can make it beautifully. This is just an elegy for, you know what, or a celebration for all of us. This was a gift to be here tonight, a total gift to be here with friends and people I haven't seen in years and, you know, people who sing so beautifully. It's called Say It. If I told you we were slapping the beat to some Barry White jam, crooning from the boom box, and that every single one of us at one point or another jumped up to shake what shook on us, and there were lines of us in step, and a loon in every one of our mouths, who knew? And one of us in his pressed shirt dancing, his dead father's hunchbacked smooth, and another singing back up like hers, and another shaking his head no, but meaning yes, oh yes. And if I told you the proprietor of this roti joint dragged his wife from the kitchen where she was busy currying chana for the best doubles in Brooklyn, so she too might witness this unabashed racket, this stampede of glee and goof, this clan of black clad. And if I told you today we laid down one too young to lay down. Praise the body, its miraculous stutter and thrum. Praise it slosh and drag and drone and every bony particulate diving toward the dirt. The rampant heart, its last kick and holler, the blood clot's last long swim to the lung. Praise the lung, its last whistle, and the kidneys, no more. Say this. Say praise the machine hiss your father became and the quick way he gave it up. Say praise the liver's dread swell. Say it again. Say it with your heart and neck and lent throat gaped and flayed to the sky. Say it covering someone's hand with yours, straightening your tie. Say it to the earth's fat mouth. Say it the way you can turn on your heel to spark fire and make your limber hip twist like a lesser storm. Or the way there is a storm between your two good hips, which are good, good music if you listen. Say it in your polished shoes. To the organist, say it too. Praise the heart, its rivers, and each rope twisted in the body, and every bird housed in the body, vulture, gull, raven, jackrabbit, cask, wick, and flame a bird too. Say praise to flame a bird too. Praise to the nerve endings in your teeth and to your tongue, like a blind man's hand reading her teeth, and the tongue inside the eyes, and the nose in the tongue, and the heart in the tongue. Say praise to salt, tear, stain, and skin ripped apart like a kite flipping in the wind. Praise the rip in the kite and the geese flying through it. Praise every flower you never smelled and every dog you never kissed and the skinny farmer at the market with bad teeth who you never kissed. Praise the handful of freckles dashed across your father's face that you never kissed until he would not wake again. Say it. Say it again. Say praise the sunlight trapped on your father's face. Say praise the body's slapdash racket slipping away. Say praise the loom and praise the lathe and praise the body, its song like a blade. If you want to or not, clean the dirt from your teeth and the glass from your fists. If you want to or not, tie both your shoes and fix your suspenders and praise the heart inside the heart, cracking its shackles, its thunderclap shrug, its 2,000 dolphins waving goodbye. Praise every day, the 2,000 dolphins waving goodbye, shaking off our hearts and waving goodbye.
Wordplay for this week. We've been listening to Ross Gay reading at Malaprops, and before that, in conversation with Joanna Cooper, who's our co-host today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in, Joanna. It's been great.
Fine for the woman who made the rain come. Seagulls sing your hearts away as wild sinners sing.